Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the amazingly successful smear campaign the Trump administration and the Fox News echo chamber has done on fabricating a distraction from the Mueller probe by demonizing the DOJ and FBI to the point that 73% of Republicans believe these institutions that Trump controls are undermining his presidency. As recently as 2015, 84% of Republicans admired the FBI, but today only 38% do. And we will look into why Republicans have gone along with Trump in destroying one of the GOP's major assets as the party of law and order. Alex Whiting, a professor at Harvard Law School who was formerly a prosecutor at the International Criminal Court and the Department of Justice, joins us to discuss his article at Just Security, President Trump and Concealing Evidence in the Russia Probe, and Trump's record of not just tearing down democratic institutions, but tearing down people who were widely admired, such as Barack Obama, John McCain, Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush, James Comey, Andrew McCabe, and now Rod Rosenstein. Then we'll analyze the criticism from around the world following the right-wing Polish government's attempt to safeguard Poland's image abroad by passing a law outlawing any accusation of Poland's complicity in the Nazi crimes committed during the Holocaust. James Kirchick, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, whose latest book is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age, joins us to discuss how Poland is joining in an unfortunate trend of outlawing international inquiry, as Putin has done in Russia by passing a law making it illegal to mention the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which ironically set the stage for the Nazi-Soviet invasion of Poland at the start of World War II. Then finally, we will speak with Eric Olson, the Deputy Director of the Latin America Program and Senior Advisor of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars, about how immigration, again, will be at the heart of whether there is another government shutdown. Now that the Senate has passed a budget bill without addressing the Dreamer issue, which the Democratic leader of the House, Nancy Pelosi, said means her caucus will not support a budget package that does not commit to a debate over DACA, the prospect of another shutdown, which Trump said he would love, looms large. And joining us now is Alex Whiting, a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, where he teaches rights and consults on domestic and international criminal prosecution issues. From 2010 until 2013, he was investigations coordinator at the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that was a U.S. federal prosecutor for 10 years, first with the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division in the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., and then with the United States Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption cases. He's also the editor of Just Security, where he has an article with Ryan Goodman, President Trump and Concealing Evidence in the Russia Probe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Whiting.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on.
Well, thank you. And already President Trump, with the help of Fox News, Breitbart, Limbaugh, etc., has succeeded, I think, in an extraordinary way. Now, apparently, 73% of Republicans believe that members of the FBI and Department of Justice are working to delegitimize President Trump through politically motivated investigations. And another poll finds that 38% of Republicans have a favorable view of the FBI. And that is down from a poll in 2015 where a huge majority of Republicans, 84%, had a favorable view of the FBI. So it's an amazing situation, is it not, that the White House, through the kind of right-wing echo chamber in the media, have launched not just a successful PR campaign, but essentially a distraction campaign.
It is, and it's one of the most depressing aspects of this whole affair, and of course it's ironic that it's the Republicans going to war on the law enforcement apparatus, the Department of Justice and the FBI of the federal government. Really, what we're seeing here is that the president, with the aid of, as you say, certain members of Congress and certain actors in the media, for his own self-interest, is going to war against the FBI and the Department of Justice, and the consequences of that are potentially long-term and devastating. Because, of course, when people lose confidence in our justice institutions and our law enforcement agencies, that renders them much less effective.
So why do you think that the Republicans have joined in attacking a law enforcement organization and essentially basically shredding their own? They owned law and order. They were the party of law and order. Why would they give it up for this man?
Well, I mean, this, of course, been one of the mysteries of the last year is why so many Republicans have been willing to put aside principle in order to advance their own narrow agendas or their own political interests. And I think people have been waiting to see when Republicans would stand up and say enough is enough. And some, of course, have. Senator Flake is a notable prominent example of that. But so many others have simply accepted the actions and words of Trump. And I think part of the problem is self-interest, and I think part of the problem is perhaps looking too much in the short term and thinking, oh, this is just Trump being Trump, and this will pass, and the institutions will survive. And I think those members of Congress and politicians, Republicans, are failing to see the long-term damage that is being done here, not just to law enforcement, but to our foreign relations, to the State Department, to our standing in the world. That kind of corrosive long-term damage is much harder to see day-to-day, but the implications could be very long-lasting and dramatic for our domestic interests and also for our international interests.
But there is something about Trump in the sense that he doesn't exactly have a stellar record, both in business and his associates, many of whom are in organized crimes and have connections to organized crime. Lots of kleptocrats, third world kleptocrats, former Soviet republics, and Russia itself have been, it's almost like his business model has been, I don't know whether it's laundering money, that's what Bannon says, and that's what the Fusion GPS people say it's all about. I guess we'll wait and see. But the long and the short of it is he's sort of dealt with some pretty sleazy people, and he hasn't paid his bills, and he's been a kind of buccaneer. But his amazing talent would seem to me is that he's really good at tearing down people who are mostly held in high regard. He tore down Barack Obama. He tore down Hillary Clinton. He tore down John McCain, who really was held in high regard in a bipartisan sense. He tore down Jeb Bush. He's done it with McCabe. He's starting to do it with Rosenstein. I don't know whether he's going to turn his attention on Mueller. He hasn't so far laid into Mueller. He's gone after Sessions. But the weird part of it is that he's been effective. So does that say something about us in general?
Well, I think it says something that we have to pay attention to about where we are in our country. Why is it that people have continued to support Trump before he got elected and during this last year of presidency? Of course his popularity is way down, and he's among many people, he's many quarters, many groups, many parts of the population, he's extremely unpopular, but he has held on to kind of a core group of supporters. And why? And I think it's because of larger economic, social forces going on in the country. About the it reflects the depth to which many people in this country feel like they have been left behind, that they have not been treated fairly by the government, that they've been forgotten by the elites. And I think there is a kind of groundswell of revolt against the government, against the elites, against the ways things have been done for the last decades. And so, ironically, what we look at, we commentators, the people talking about this on the radio, what we look at is, violations of norms and transgressions and, kind of shocking things that the president has done. I think for some people that reinforces his popularity because they see it as a poke in the eye to the elite groups that for too long have forgotten them. And so I actually worry. I write a lot about the Mueller investigation and about Trump's attacks on the law enforcement and so forth, the things that we've been talking about. But I worry that for many people, this is not the important issue. This misses the point for Trump supporters. They're not interested in that. What they're interested in, and I understand this, and I think we have to pay attention to it in dealing with Trump and answering him, is what they're interested in is jobs and fairness and equality and the economy and the imbalances in the economy, the rich getting richer and their wages not going up and their security is threatened. That's where I think his support comes from.
But he's doing everything against people who have those priorities. I mean, that's the bizarre part about it. If you're interested in economic justice and fairness, you know, look at the tax bill. It does the opposite. It's very puzzling. But I have to add, by the way, to the list of people that were held in high regard that he's torn down, of course, is James Comey. I mean, he's talking about a Boy Scout. Everybody admired what he did standing up to the Cheney during the Bush administration. And, you know, he's a Republican. Hillary Clinton thinks he cost her the election. And yet Trump has turned on him in the most obsessive and venomous way. So that is something that I still can't get my head around. But in general, what's your sense of, is there a way to get this narrative out? We know that the Democrats haven't been very good at spinning things. And by the way, I have to add, when you said Trump's low in the polls, Quinnipiac just today announced a poll where he's gone up to 40%. So he's going up in the polls at the moment. But, you know, the government shutdown, of course, did not help the Democrats. So what kind of narrative do you think they can have in terms of explaining what's happening in simple terms? The best analogy I've come up with is that what Trump is doing is the equivalent of, if you were pulled over by a cop for speeding, you would then turn around and investigate the cop for adultery.
Right. So I think I would say two things. The first is that I think that the Democrats have to continue to focus on the economic justice issues. And you're absolutely right that the president and the Republicans have not served the interests of his core supporters. And I can only hope that that eventually catches up to him. But that is a message that has to be reinforced by the Democrats. And then with respect to the question about the investigation and his conduct with respect to law enforcement, I think that's right. That I think that ultimately people have notions, clear and fundamental notions and values about respecting the law, about telling the truth, about allowing investigations to go forward, and I think that if that is framed as the president is trying to stop, has been trying to obstruct an investigation, trying to stop the truth from coming out, trying to protect people close to him, I have confidence. I hope that message, if it's presented clearly, will eventually resonate. I think people understand that. I think they have those fundamental values, and that has to be continue to be presented clearly to the public.
But in terms of the fact that you got the 73% of the Republicans believing Trump's canard, that somehow the FBI and the DOJ are full of Clinton supporters who are undermining his victory and have come up with this, what he calls the Russian hoax. How do you turn that around? Because, as I say, you know, in the real world, you can't pick your prosecutors, which is what he's trying to do. And in the real world, if you're being charged with something, particularly something that's important to Trump as his election victory, that it's somehow not legitimate, the first thing he'd want to do is clear the air, which he hasn't done. He's done the opposite. He's obstructed. So that's extremely suspicious. So I just don't feel, when I look at the statistics that I've quoted here about how successful Trump and Fox and Breitbart and Limbaugh have been at getting the entire Republican voters, or 73% of them, to believe that what he's doing now, which is, an obstruction of justice, it's also the destruction of a institution, a law enforcement institution in this country, the FBI, and by extension, the Department of Justice. So he's doing real damage, and I just don't know how you can stop, you know, obviously it has to be stopped. Trump's talking about stopping Adam Schiff, for God's sake, but who's stopping him?
Well, I understand your I understand the pessimism, and I worry too. But remember that so far Mueller has not spoken, right? Has not spoken about Trump and the evidence against him, and he may never speak. Mueller may conclude his investigation and conclude that there isn't enough there to go forward, and that may be the end of it. But if he does speak, that will have a dramatic and important effect. And Trump has had the stage so far. He's had the microphone. But if Mueller decides to put forward the evidence, either as charges against people close to Trump or as information that Congress should consider for impeachment purposes, people will listen to that, and then it will be a matter of the evidence. And there will be some people who will support Trump no matter what the evidence is. But I suspect that if there is a report put forward, if there is evidence of obstruction, or if it turns out there's evidence of collusion, or if there's evidence, as you alluded earlier, to other financial crimes that Trump has been involved in, once evidence is put forward, that can really change the narrative and change the conversation. And I suspect that's where the dramatic shift would occur.
Well, just in the last minute, I don't mean to be a wet blanket here, but this is not the Starr investigation, which was done under the independent counsel statute, where Starr was required to make his report public. My understanding is that Rosenstein is not required to make this report public by Mueller.
You're right about that. And it may be that Mueller would put the information forward. However, and then it would not become public or would not be transmitted to Congress. However, I think that if Mueller has information, has gathered evidence that could support an impeachment, either obstruction, collusion, or other financial crimes, I think it's going to be very difficult for Rosenstein to just bury that. The pressure on him to either make that public or at least make it available to Congress will be staggering. So, yes, you're right. The Rosenstein formally has that power. I doubt that he would be able to do that as a political matter.
Well, Alex Whiting, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Alex Whiting, who's a professor of practice at Harvard Law School. He was investigations coordinator at the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that was a U.S. federal prosecutor for 10 years, first with the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., and then with the United States Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption cases. And he's also the editor of Just Security, where he has an article with Ryan Goodman, President Trump, and concealing evidence in the Russia probe. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the criticism coming from around the world at Poland's right-wing government, who just passed a law outlawing any accusation of Poland's complicity in the Nazi war crimes committed during the Holocaust.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No, it's your head.
Time to send someone away. Got my back covered. How you been all led astray? Come, let's count. It's absurd. They lead you to the race, but no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from southern and northern Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent, and the Caucasus. He is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, a columnist for Tablet magazine, and a correspondent for the Daily Beast. And his latest book is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kirchick.
Thanks for having me.
And Poland's President Duda signed a law on Tuesday that outlaws accusing Poland of complicity in the Nazi crimes committed under the Nazi occupation. Half of the Jews murdered in the Holocaust were Polish Jews, or were killed in Poland. But in his Tel Aviv address, Mr. Duda said that the aim of the law was to safeguard Poland's image abroad. Well, that image has taken a beating from the very law that is enacted, so I don't get it. What's going on?
Well, I think there's several issues to unpack here. One is there's a particular term that this law has outlawed, which is the term Polish death camps. And you might recall a couple of years ago there was a controversy when President Obama was giving a posthumous Presidential Medal of Freedom to a very heroic Polish man named Jan Karski, who was really the man who sort of broke the news of the death camps by smuggling out information out of Poland. In the speech that President Obama gave, that was clearly written by a speechwriter who didn't do his homework, he had referred to Polish death camps. And that's obviously something that's very sensitive to Poles. The Nazi death camps were created by Germans. They happened to be in Poland. And so it's understandable why Poles would be sensitive about that particular term. I don't think it should be outlawed, because I happen to be a free speech absolutist, but I can understand why Poles would be sensitive about that. What's a little more pernicious about this law is that it basically makes it illegal to talk about any degree of Polish complicity in the Holocaust. And then by that, I don't mean the Polish state. I mean, there was no Polish puppet state. There was no Polish collaboration with Hitler. That's something that Poles can actually be quite proud of. I mean, you compare Poland's record in that regard to that of any of its neighbors in Europe, where, you know, Vichy France, or you had in the Baltic states, you had very willing participation in the murder of Jews in Hungary, obviously, as well. You know, Poland was unique in that fact, and that Poles were seen as Slavs, and they were eternal enemies of the Nazis, and they were to be, you know, liquidated as well. And there are many Polish Catholic or non-Jewish people who died in Auschwitz as well. But after the war, there were massacres of Jews by Poles, and even during the war, frankly, there were Poles who, you know, turned in their Jewish neighbors. On the other hand, of course, there are more what's referred to as Righteous of the Nation. This is the honor that Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Museum in Israel, gives to Gentiles who have saved Jews during the war. There are more Poles who are honored, who are given that honor, than any other people on earth. So it's a very mixed picture. I mean, there are very heroic Poles who risk their lives, and like Jan Karski, who I just mentioned, and there are numerous others, thousands of others, who are honored for having saved their Jewish neighbors. But there were also Poles who participated in murders of Jews. And what this law does is really makes it impossible to talk about an issue that really deserves nuance and care, and it's turning it into a black and white subject.
Well, specifically, the law says whoever accuses publicly and against the facts the Polish nation or the Polish state of being responsible or complicit in the Nazi crimes committed by the Third Reich shall be subject to a fine or a penalty of imprisonment of up to 3 years. And then there's a caveat that a person is not committing a crime if he or she commits such an act as part of artistic or scientific activities. So the first question that arises out of that is, what's the difference between the Polish nation and the Polish state?
Oh, I think it's very difficult to interpret these things. And you can see the difficulty of this. In fact, that when the Polish prime minister was giving a video address in defense of the law, he actually stumbled and referred to Polish death camps himself. So, you know, would he be criminalized, or would that speech be criminalized under this law? I think, look, any time you put the state in charge of deciding what speech should be allowed, you're going to run into problems like this. And there really can't be a neutral arbiter in this regard. And that's just where I stand. Obviously, you know, Europeans, by and large, European governments have different attitudes towards this than we do in the United States. You know, Germany obviously bans Holocaust denial, and there are similar laws in other countries. Some of the post-Soviet countries make it illegal to deny, you know, Soviet crimes, but I mean, it's really ultimately in the eye of the beholder, and that's what makes this law such a problem.
Well, indeed, Putin passed a law that you get imprisoned for talking about complicity with the Nazis.
Right.
In the Hitler-Stalin Pact. And, of course,
exactly.
You know, it wasn't just the Germans who invaded Poland and began World War II. The Russians invaded from the other side as well.
It's a good point you raise. I've just actually, you know, this is it's unfortunate to see this sort of Russian-Soviet-style historical revisionism, you know, creeping west. And you see, you know, in Hungary for years, there's been a historical whitewash campaign by the government of Viktor Orban to deny Hungarian complicity in the Holocaust. Now it's coming into Poland. And I have to say, you see the fights that are now erupting within the community of Western nations, that is EU, NATO members, America, and even Israel is now, you know, in a war of words with Poland. I can't, you know, imagine how happy the Russians are seeing this, seeing countries that should be allies and that ultimately do share basic values are fighting amongst ourselves over something like this.
What I find disturbing, though, James, is that, you know, there are degrees of Holocaust denial, and apparently there are fears amongst Holocaust survivors that they could face criminal charges in giving testimony that incriminates Poles. And, of course, you know, there aren't that many Holocaust survivors left. But just personally, I get a lot of angry mail from people with obviously with Polish names for coverage that I've done about this new government in Poland that is moving to the right, taking over the courts. They've already taken over the media. And there was a big national holiday recently at which a number of protesters marched saying pure blood, or I think it was. But there were also apparently some even shouting Sieg Heil. And this furious indignation from these letters that I got saying that it didn't happen, but it was cited all over the place by the AP and others. So what's that denial about? You know, I mean, for the life of me, I don't understand why you would want to deny this stuff. You know, you'd think you'd want to deal with it because it's so peculiar that anybody in a country that suffered so much at the hands of the Nazis could be shouting Sieg Heil.
Well, I think at that particular march you mentioned, the numbers of people who were neo-Nazis shouting Sieg Heil was very small. That's not to deny that they weren't there. I do think they were small, and they were not representative of the march itself, which was, you know, you could say was a right-of-center nationalist, you know, pro-government march, but I don't think it'd be fair to characterize that entire crowd of 100,000 or so people as being neo-Nazis, because as you say, I mean, the notion of a Polish neo-Nazi is quite oxymoronic, considering how many Poles died at the hands of the Nazis during World War II. But yes, the defensiveness is there. Look, I think Poland is a very proud nation, and I don't necessarily mean that in a negative way. Poles have a lot to be proud about. I mean, they have fought very valiantly and courageously against oppression throughout their history, not only against the Nazis, but against the Soviets. And, you know, there are other countries that can't speak to such a record of courage, frankly, and I won't name them. But the Poles do have a proud record of laying down their lives against, you know, foreign invaders. And that's something that they're very rightly proud about. Sometimes that pride can seep into a negative direction and become, you know, quite defensive of any sort of criticism of the country. And I think this particular issue of the Holocaust law, I think, you know, the careful observers, the people who know what they're talking about, no one is accusing Poland, the state, or the majority of its people of having participated in the Holocaust. You know, serious people understand that Auschwitz was a German-constructed and almost entirely German-operated concentration camp, extinction camp, where many Poles themselves died. And they understand, and I understand, that calling it a Polish death camp is wrong. But that doesn't preclude us from also discussing the fact that some Poles did participate and did kill Jews, just like there were collaborators across Europe, frankly. I mean, look, most people in Europe in that period were not heroes. Most people went along with the horrible events that were occurring in their country, and if they weren't active collaborators, they were passive collaborators. And that's just a fact. And I think that, you know, all countries need to grapple with their history and understand it. And I think, you know, no country really does that better than Germany, in my opinion, having lived there and you see the honesty with which the Germans confront their own history. And I think the Poles could maybe take a lesson from that.
Well, you know, there were, of course, as you mentioned earlier, some Poles informed on Jews who were hiding, and they were paid rewards, of course, by the Nazis, and others participated in massacres, as you mentioned. There was one in Jedwabne, where hundreds of Jews were murdered by their neighbors. And then even in 1946, there was a pogrom against Jews returning to their property, which had been confiscated. And now the Polish citizens living in their property obviously didn't want to give it up. So, but every country has this kind of history. I mean, I worked in the 60s in France when de Gaulle was in power. And, you know, there was a conscious effort on the part of de Gaulle to play down the role of collaboration during the World War II by the Vichy government and by a lot of French people. Even Coco Chanel was living with a top Gestapo officer during the war. So, and I never quite understood that. I guess it's about recreating national myths. I mean, de Gaulle, who of course led the Free French, I suppose what he was doing was trying to instill some kind of patriotism, but at the expense of a denial of history. And it took some French documentary filmmakers to make a film called The Sorrow and the Pity to burst that bubble. And it was there was quite a lot of resistance to the release of that film at the time. So, you know, we all have national myths. I mean, the Southerners have the myth of the noble Confederacy that's alive and well today. So how much are these national myths manipulated by politicians?
Well, you cite, you know, General de Gaulle, and, you know, one could argue that in order to basically bring the country together after World War II, there was this necessity, perhaps, of ignoring some parts of the country's history, that, you know, it was only a figure like de Gaulle who could bring the French out of Algeria, just like it was, you know, Nixon who could go to China. And I think there's been a reckoning. You know, it took a long time for France to really have its reckoning. You could say it's still even going on, or they haven't even, you know, achieved it yet. The fact that, you know, Marine Le Pen, who did so well in the presidential election, you know, last year, getting about 34% of the vote. I mean, she clearly has not accepted the interpretation of French history that is sort of that is advanced by the mainstream. You know, even in Germany, it took them decades, really, to come to they call it the Vergangenheitsbewältigung, which means coming to terms with the past. I mean, that they didn't really start doing that fully until the 1980s. It wasn't until the miniseries Holocaust, which was an American one, was broadcast in Germany that the country really began this process. I mean, there were the Auschwitz trials in the 60s when the horrors were brought to a large audience in Germany, but it really didn't begin to take effect until the 1980s. And, you know, now you have a country where, you know, every school child visits some sort of concentration camp where there is a large memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe in the heart of Berlin, right next to the Brandenburg Gate. So I do think it's very important for countries to honestly grapple with their past. In fact, it's hard for me to think of a more stark contrast in why this is important. If you look at the way Germany confronts its past and the way Russia confronts its past, Germany, as I said, acknowledges the crimes that were committed and the mistakes that were made and has tried to come to terms with that and teaches future generations. And you can see that, you know, no one in Europe is frightened by Germany. No one fears a German military invasion. Today, Germany is probably the most popular country in the world, in fact, I believe, according to a BBC poll. Compare that to Russia, where Stalin is venerated, where, as you mentioned before, it is illegal now to talk about the Hitler-Stalin pact, where the crimes of the Soviet Union are not discussed in any healthy way. And every neighbor of Russia fears it. And Russia today is a dictatorship, and it treats its own people poorly, and it threatens its neighbors. And I think that a large part of that has to do with the fact that it hasn't honestly grappled with its past. So I think that's why this is important. I can't think of a clearer example of how this affects, you know, current geopolitics than the contrast between Germany and Russia.
And, of course, in Germany, they finally, Merkel's finally got a government together with the old coalition partner. It's taken a while. And, of course, a lot of press about the rise of the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, the right-wing party, and how they're courting the labor movement. But just in terms of our leadership here, you know, Trump, of course, supported Brexit, which has been a catastrophe, and they still can't kind of figure it out. I hope they come to their senses and somehow abandon it, because if you poll the Brits today, they definitely have buyer's remorse.
Mm.
And then, of course, he never endorsed NATO. I mean, it's almost like he's doing Putin's job for him. How do you measure your thesis in the book, The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age, currently? Is your prediction coming more true or less?
Well, it's hard for me to be very optimistic. I mean, if you look at the major elections that were held last year in the three biggest European countries, I mean, in France, you could say superficially that the center held. But let's look more closely. In France, Marine Le Pen doubled the percentage that her father won. In Germany, we now have a far-right party as of today. If this coalition agreement goes through, a far-right party, the Alternative for Deutschland, will be the official opposition sitting in Parliament. And in the UK, as you mentioned, I mean, Brexit is a shambles. There's no real light at the end of the tunnel. The government doesn't know what it's doing, which leads me to believe that we're on our way to getting a Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn, which I think is an utter disaster. If you look at certainly the transatlantic relationship is not very healthy with Donald Trump. I think the worst fears of some of us in terms of policy towards Europe and Russia under Trump have not yet really materialized. In fact, the policy has been Russia has been pleasantly surprising, at least in the sale of weapons to Ukraine, the continued support for NATO, the Magnitsky sanctions. A lot of this, I think, is not because of Donald Trump, but rather in spite of him. It's sort of the bureaucracy working around him. It's Jim Mattis. It's other officials who don't share the president's views of Russia and Putin. But it's hard for me to look at Europe and look at the problems that I address in the book and be too optimistic. I mean, maybe the one bright sign is Greece seems to be moving back into economic growth. But aside from that, it's hard for me to be too optimistic.
But just in closing, there was, of course, a recent visit by Netanyahu with Orban in Hungary, where they were sort of buddies. And it's a bit ironic, isn't it, that these countries that are where there's this white nationalism emerging have that kind of relationship. But I think the real irony, surely, is that the new victims of prejudice and hatred in Europe are not the Jews, but the Muslims.
I'm not really sure about that. I mean, I think both are hated. But you could say anti-Semitic attitudes among Muslims in Europe are much higher than any other group. But clearly there are people who have bigoted attitudes towards Muslims. In return, certainly the violent, murderous attacks on people are almost exclusively of Jews. I can't think of many, and they're all committed by Muslims. I'm not aware of any murderous attacks on Muslims in Europe, per se, in recent years. Regarding Prime Minister Netanyahu, I think he's made a calculation that the Hungarian government will perhaps, you know, support him on his discrete issues as Prime Minister of Israel, and he clearly hasn't given much thought to the effect on the Jewish community in Hungary, which is clearly negatively affected by a government that is trying to rewrite the history of the Holocaust and that is launching a vicious campaign against George Soros, which is hard for me to see as anything but certainly has anti-Semitic overtones to it. I mean, the obsession, you know, plastering this man's face all over the country as if he's sort of a comic book villain. In a nation that has such a difficult history with anti-Semitism, I think it's a very irresponsible thing for the Hungarian government to be doing, and it's not appropriate for an Israeli prime minister to be essentially, you know, kosherizing it by visiting it in such a positive way.
Well, James Kacik, you've given us a lot to think about, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent, who's reported from Southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, a columnist for Tablet magazine, and a correspondent for the Daily Beast. And his latest book is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how immigration again will be at the heart of whether there is another government shutdown.
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Olson, the Deputy Director of the Latin America Program and Senior Advisor of the Mexican Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Olson.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And today, the Senate leaders, McConnell and Schumer, have agreed to keep the government going for a couple of years in a budget package that increases defense spending by $80 billion in the current fiscal year and $85 billion next year. And a part of that, of course, sweetening the package for the Democrats. There's an increase in non-defense spending by $63 billion this year and $68 billion next year. But already Nancy Pelosi in the House is saying she's not going to agree to any budget deal that's not accompanied by a debate over DACA and the Dreamers. So yesterday, Trump more or less welcomed the idea of shutting down the government if he didn't get his wall, and using the specter of the MS-13 street gang as though they were invading the country and killing Americans wholesale. So these are the politics of the border, seem to be inextricably bound in whether or not this budget deal is going to get through. And of course, if it doesn't, if they can't pass a temporary funding measure by the end of Thursday, either tied to the on its own or tied to this budget deal coming out of the Senate, the government will shut down for a second time. So it's an extraordinary situation, to say the least, Ryan.
Without a doubt. I mean, I think there's historically, there's been various reasons why U.S. government is shut down, having to do with budget deficits and government programs of different kinds, and you know, often it's an ideological battle of some sort. Never before has migration per se really been the basis of a debate about whether government should stay open or close. Last time around, which was really only about 10 days ago, it was the Democrats who insisted that there be a vote on DACA, part of the budget deal that would extend the government. This time around, it seems to be President Trump who's pushing for a shutdown if there is no vote on border enforcement. I think ultimately the border wall is what he's after, and DACA gets stuck in there. I think one of the tragedies here is that we kind of lose sight of the human being, the human element here, what's happening in people's lives and how their lives could be, almost in an instant, turned upside down and their futures, you know, kind of put into question. So it's tragic. It's too bad. It's unfortunate. I think all reasonable people would think they could come to some agreement here, but doesn't seem to be happening.
But the broader politics, if you go back to the shutdown, the recent one, the three-day one, it was more or less the real battle was on how both sides spun the shutdown and who got blamed. And I think Trump was successful in getting the message out to his people that the Democrats care more about illegal immigrants than they do about you, the American people. And he seems to be encouraging that narrative now. He's almost goading the government to shut down over this conflation that he does between the MS-13 street gang and the Dreamers, as though they're all lumped into this. You know, we all recall what he first said when he announced his presidency, that Mexicans are a bunch of rapists and murderers.
I mean, I to me, you know, and the Wilson Center, our focus is really on the policy and the implications and what all this means. I'm not a real politico per se, and so I have some you know, real serious doubts about the wisdom of making the MS-13 sort of the rationale and conflating it with, you know, DACA and the other group is the TPSers, the temporary protected status. There are 200,000 Salvadorans that are protected by this TPS status that is now, you know, they've gone unnoticed that they may be deported in the next 18 months as well. And there's a way in which we conflate vicious criminal organizations, without a doubt, with, you know, people who have registered, who have played by the rules, once they've registered, are hardworking, own homes, have U.S. citizen children. They happen to be from El Salvador, or they happen to be from Mexico, but they, you know, the vast majority don't have anything to do with MS-13, and in fact, as bad as MS-13 is, there are many other gangs in this country, some of them with connections internationally, that can be as vicious and worse. So MS-13, I'm not, you know, making them into, you know, a benevolent organization by any stretch. They're a vicious group in many cases, but there are all their groups and other or criminal organizations that have done similar things. And we seem to be elevating them above these other organizations.
Well, together with Donald Trump saying that I'd love to shut down the government if we don't get a deal on stopping MS-13 and building his wall. And there again, I don't know what building a wall has got to do with stopping MS-13 or what the building of the wall has got to do with anything, because first of all, the Mexicans were supposed to pay for it. And it seems like an absurd waste of money. And for some reason or other, the Democrats aren't focusing on that. They seem to be willing to actually make a deal to give him some money for his wall. But on top of that, the chief of staff, General Kelly, who a lot of people thought was going to be one of the adults in the room to restrain Trump, he made some very, very, you know, I guess sort of racist remarks against Latinos by suggesting these DACA kids were too lazy to sign up for DACA and they couldn't get off the couch or get off their asses, as he said. So this is a bit of a surprise, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people thought Kelly would be able to restrain Trump, but it seems like Trump and Kelly are on the same page.
I mean, I don't know the inner workings or inner thoughts of John Kelly, but he has towed a pretty tough line, and so has the new Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, who was his chief of staff over at the White House. They've taken a pretty hard line on TPS, again, this temporary protected status that was extended to Haitians and Salvadorans and Hondurans and a number of other people. And he has, you know, said quite, told the administration's lines on DACA. Look, I think people need to, you know, look at who the TPS recipients are, who the DACA recipients are. Because they register, they have to also go through background checks. They're not criminals. They haven't committed crimes since they've registered, or they wouldn't be eligible for these status. We know that the TPS recipients from Salvador and Guatemala are very involved in the workforce, are hardworking, own homes, contribute to their communities. I think it's a real mistake to sort of conflate them, as you suggested, with the MS-13 folks, the gang members that are here, but are not receiving TPS or DACA protection. I think that's something that we have to be very clear about. The question of the wall is an interesting one. The majority of people that are here without documentation come through ports of entry legally. They come with tourist visas, temporary visas, and overstay. I'm not, convinced that building a wall is going to keep MS-13 or other drug traffickers out, because people are actually coming through ports of entry with the proper documentation. So the wall seems to me to kind of, again, divert attention to the real issue.
But President Trump, of course, singled out the parents of Kayla Cuevas and Nisa Mickens, who were both bludgeoned to death and hacked to death with machetes by MS-13 gang members. They were, they were both 16-year-old kids. Their parents were guests of the president at the State of the Union, and they cried when Donald Trump told the story of the children's death. So there's no question that Trump is making an emphasis on that, and on the other side, you've got Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer making an emphasis on the Dreamers. And again, there's obviously no comparison. And one wonders why the president is doing this, because it does sort of more or less stigmatize the idea of immigration and Latinos in this kind of horrible kind of grab bag. Is there anything that can be done, though, to stop this revolving door of the MS-13? Because they started out as street gangs here in Los Angeles in the 1980s. They were usually, refugee children from the Civil War. And then they started to get deported in the 1990s back to El Salvador, and they've been coming back and forth ever since. And they have so much criminal power down in El Salvador itself. They control neighborhoods. And of course, the Barrio 18 gang, which is also created in Los Angeles, is equally vicious. Kids down there are forced to join. They'll either kill you or turn you into a killer. That's your choice. Or you can emigrate north, which is a hazardous trip through Mexico to the United States. And that's the program that, as you mentioned, TPS, that Sessions has shut down. So what is our strategy? There doesn't seem to be a strategy except to try and sort of do a whack-a-mole situation and just close the door. Not that that's practical, even with Trump's wall.
Well, I would say two things. One is, as you point out, the administration and Trump in particular has made border security and a tough migrant policy, anti-migrant policy, a cornerstone of his campaign, of his presidency, and he feels a lot of commitment to that aspect of it. The second point is what goes on and what's happening in Central America. Here I would say that they have an announced policy. We can debate whether it's adequate, whether it's being implemented fully, but their own policy says that they are investing in Central America to try to address the drivers of migration. And the drivers of migration, by their own words, are, violence, lack of governance, which we could call corruption and lack of rule of law, and lack of economic opportunity. Those are their stated policy priorities in Central America. And, at the rhetorical level, I would frankly agree with it. The solution here is not building walls and exporting more people. It's dealing with the problems in Central America. I have written an article that says the U.S., you know, the decision on TPS to send back 200,000 Salvadorans and 56,000 Hondurans will actually be a self-inflicted wound on the United States. We're sending them back to a volatile region that we're trying to stabilize. We will make it more volatile, and more people will continue to migrate. So I think it's, you know, they in some ways are undermining or potentially undermining their own policy. Now, are they effectively dealing with the problem of violence and anti-corruption and lack of economic opportunity in the Northern Territory? That's another question. But at least that's their commitment, or that's their stated goal.
But my understanding is that young El Salvadorans, whose parents set them on this dangerous journey through Mexico, where they really face hideous obstacles, and to then surrender at the U.S. border, that
happens in part.
Yeah,
that's part of the process. But I wouldn't say that that's always the case.
Right.
There's, you know, the long history of family migration between Central America and the United States.
Right.
From the period of the civil wars in Central America.
Right, and of course that's what is referred to as chain migration by the Trump administration. It's something
right.
they want to end. But what I was going to say was that it sounds like for a young person trying, you know, to go to school and you know, have a career and have a decent life, you're preyed upon, and to some extent you're caught in the crossfire between the gangs and the police, and the police have also been guilty of human rights violations as well. So it's almost like El Salvador is having another civil war. In this case, it's not the communist guerrillas in the hills fighting these fascist military, but it's the gangs versus the police. Is that an accurate characterization?
I mean that's true in great part. I guess, you know, I wouldn't call it a civil war because it's not actually gangs trying to take over the country, but there is an enormous civil conflict in El Salvador. There's no question about it. And I think one of the interesting things to ask oneself is, given how difficult the situation in El Salvador is, we know that their homicide rate is one of the highest in the world, that there are all kinds of problems in terms of economic opportunity. They still prefer, you know, many Salvadoran young people still prefer to risk the dangers of heading north and going through Mexico than staying there in El Salvador. It's kind of it gives you an idea of how bad things are in El Salvador if young people choose to face, you know, the dangers of the trek north and uncertain future once they get to the United States rather than stay behind. And that's part of the problem. Until we can solve the problems in El Salvador, in Honduras, and I don't mean it's just up to the U.S. to solve them. Those countries have to solve them as well. We can help in that process. But until those issues are addressed, I think it's highly unlikely that the migrant streams are going to stop, because people are faced with incredibly long arms, long odds, and high rates of violence.
Well, Eric Olson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Very welcome. Glad to do it.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Olson, who's Deputy Director of the Latin American Program and Senior Advisor of the Mexican Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.